check done. Let's see. Are you hearing it? You're not?
One, two, there. There, but only on the left side. There. There.
Okay. Well, it needs to be plugged into the,
all right.
The
try.
Metal side.
Okay.
So
1, 2. It's pretty low. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Hang on.
This volume.
Try it now.
Hello, hello. No, gone. Hello, 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 hello. Oh, now you're cooking. Hey, now we're rocking and rolling here. Are we live?
We're live.
All right. Now, this is a very sensitive microphone, so that you won't necessarily have to.
Hopefully, it won't. Well, folks, are we ready?
Yes.
Don, if you've got sound to your earphones, we should be good to go. Well, if we could just begin by having each of you identify yourselves and indicate where you live now.
Ann Carinas Broussard. I live in Patterson, Louisiana.
Jody Carinas. Live in Morgan City, Louisiana.
Diane Carinas Austin, and I live in Albemarle, North Carolina.
Well, as we indicated to you earlier, we're simply here to try to record your family's contributions to the local seafood industry, both in the Manhattan and in shrimp processing and fisheries, offshore fisheries. So I guess the best place to start is for you to tell us a little bit about your father, who really was the pioneer in all of this. And tell us a little bit about him and his background, how he came to be involved.
He was born in 1896 in Olhão, Portugal.
Okay, and your father's name was?
John Santos Carinas. He died April 16, 1976. He came to this country when he was 16 years old. He had two brothers already here, and they worked in New York fishing. Later, he came down south, and he ended up in Fernandina Beach, and then ended in St. Augustine, Florida.
Why? What was the reason for his migration south? Did he just find a job?
He was shrimping. Mm-hmm. And he met a J.J. Hansen, and they shrimped the boats in Southport, I think, South Carolina, and in Florida. And then from Fernandina, he moved to St. Augustine. And he worked with some of the Basagis, I believe, I'm not sure.
And the Salvadors.
And the Salvadors. Working for them on a boat until he was able to accumulate enough money to get his own boat.
What year would that be, approximately?
Oh, I don't know. I have records that may show it, mm-hmm. articles that may show all this. I don't have everything mm-hmm. up here.
But it was pre-World War II?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He was 16, and he was when he came to this country, and he was born in, like I said, 1896. So, and he migrated south, and then he started. After he accumulated enough money, he got his own boat, and then eventually, I think the shrimp was playing out in Florida, and they ended up down here. He was the second. Shrimper with boats to come in the area.
Now he brought his own boat.
He had some boats, yes, when he came here.
So he had more than one boat?
I'm not sure about that.
Now, were they sail or were they?
Well, they were first powered. In the early days, the shrimp boats were first powered with kerosene, and he ended up being nicknamed Kerosene John. But as the years progressed and they started having the different engines. Mm-hmm. But when he was down here, they had a gold mine with the shrimp.
Now, inland or deep water? Because Morgan City is known for deep water shrimp as well.
Gulf, in the Gulf.
Deep water.
Okay, so he had to be one of the pioneers in deep water shrimp.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when he moved here, did he bring crews with him from Florida? Did he recruit new crews?
There was some that came, but a lot of people in the area started working on the boats and became, and they used to haul the shrimp in big old shrimp trucks to the markets in New York. They weren't refrigerated. They just had them in crates and iced down. Hmm. And they had truck drivers to drive them up to, I guess it was New York, or maybe sometimes it was Washington, D.C., I'm not sure. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Now, those trucks were coming from Patterson, Morgan City.
From Patterson.
Now, when there, you have to have a boat, you have to maintain a boat. Your father spoke, I'm sure, Portuguese. Did he bring any other Portuguese with him to Morgan City? And the reason I ask is that Carl and I have found in the Morgan City archives some incredible photography that we think may be Portuguese, mending nets.
Uh-huh. I have a picture right up here with the net men mending nets. But they were brought later when he went into the menhaden business.
Okay.
They worked on the menhaden nets, mm-hmm. and some of the shrimp, but mostly the menhaden. Mm-hmm. And he had a net shop with someone doing most of the shrimp nets, but the Portuguese men did the menhaden nets.
Now, did he eventually get into shrimp processing, or was it always a case of sending the catch directly off?
Oh, no. They processed the shrimp off the boats here. Mm-hmm. But to sell the shrimp, they had to put them in trucks, ice them down, put them in trucks, and take them to market, whether it was New York or wherever.
Okay. And when we're talking about processing, we're talking about just deheading them, or was anything more done to the shrimp before they were put in cases and shipped off?
Well, in those days, they had headers, I believe, huh, Daddy? In the early days.
They were catching so much they couldn't head them on the boat, just bring them in.
Mm-hmm. Brought them in and headed them.
Because I headed shrimp with all the little workers. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fun. I'm quite a bit younger. Well, I'm the youngest. And I have somewhat of a different perspective and more of a, I don't know, sentimental type perspective. But I'm Diane Carinas Austin, and when my daddy moved down to the Fernandina area, I understand that he went back to Portugal to take a wife. And came back with her, and she died of influenza. Hmm. And when he was working with the Salvadors and the Versagis, my grandmother was a Salvador. And she died early, I guess, of influenza too.
She was not a Salvador, she was a Versagi.
She was a Versagi, right. Because my Aunt Salvador was a Versace, and let's see, there were what, 5 kids? How many? Mama's family.
I have to stop and count.
How about it, Ginger? How many kids in
5.
Some boys, some girls. But my mother lived with my Aunt Salvador, and some of those children went to an orphanage.
My mother did.
Your mother did.
Her mother died when she was 2 weeks old.
Okay. So my Aunt Virginia died when Grandma was, when Aunt Virginia Aunt Virginia was born, and then Grandma died. So my dad, having no wife, and my grandfather, Tringali, needed to look for a wife for all the girls, arranged a marriage between my mother, Frances Tringali, and her nickname was Chichina, and to my father, who was an upcoming, wealthy, young fisherman of the time. And so it was a lifelong marriage, and I'm sure it was a rocky one. But when the boats came, weren't some of you born in Florida?
What?
Where were you born?
Four of us were born in St. Augustine, Florida. She was born in Louisiana.
And I was born here.
So the influenza would have been about 1918, 1920, because that was the great influenza epidemic in this country.
And it probably got my grandmother. And my dad's first wife was Rosa Bent Carinas. Really pronounced Carinas.
Now, from St. Augustine, you brought your boats to Louisiana?
He brought some. I don't know that how many he had or what, but he came to Louisiana. He, by then, had stopped shrimping himself. He just ran the business. And he built what we called a fish house.
The fish house.
And they operated out there. They unloaded the boats and they headed them, and then they put them, like I said, in these large crates with ice and put them on these big trailer trucks.
Well, I have a couple of questions. First, you talked about the Portuguese who came in to do the Menhaden fishery later. The people from what is now Croatia who came in to do oyster fishing below New Orleans, they would go back to visit family periodically.
Exactly.
Did your dad go back too, and is that how he recruited people later on?
Yes.
Yes. He had a contact in Portugal who was an attorney that helped him get the papers and all in order to bring these men over here. And he housed them. He fed them, and he paid them.
Getting back to the shrimp industry, you said your dad was operating boats. He wasn't operating them himself, but had boats operating out in the fishery off the coast. Was he supplying these boats? Did he send supply boats out from Patterson or Morgan City to supply the boats and they stayed out and they brought the catch back in?
And now when I came along, it was more of a more mechanical of an operation. They would actually unload and it would go onto a conveyor and the shrimp would go through a grater. So the different sizes would be all together. And then they were boxed and then they were glazed and put in the freezer. So it was a quick
glaze. At that period of time, you had freezers.
Right.
Before that, they didn't have freezers, so they had to get those shrimp out of here in a hurry.
Oh, and the other story I wanted to tell, I get so excited about this. I don't know half of it. She can correct me. But my uncle was Aunt Nellie's husband. Anyway, his nickname was Smokey Pete. And he drove for Dad. And he was known for getting those shrimp wherever he had to get them very quickly, dodging the cops, you know, all kinds of stories that you can imagine from that era. Did your dad drive?
Yes.
Ginger's dad, Uncle Ralph White, did drive for Dad also. So it was pretty much of a family type of an employer, you know, people he could trust and knew would do a good job for him.
Don, I know you had some questions. I've got a bunch,
well,
too.
Well, one of the things that I think is real fascinating, go back before, you know, you're putting them in boxes. And what Carl was addressing is that if you go towards Bayou Lafourche, fishermen would go out and fish, but they were working for a fish house, your father's fish house. In order to keep the shrimpers working, the fish house would send a boat out, which we would call a grocery boat, and that would take groceries, in some cases ice. So the fishermen never left
the fishing grounds.
The fishing grounds. And that way they would offload the shrimp to the grocery boat. The hold was big enough. And they were constantly at work. And we wanted to know if your father had the same arrangement.
I don't remember an arrangement like
okay.
that.
Okay. Well, there was also an arrangement out
they took their groceries. Now, I don't know how far back you're going with this, you know, where they take the groceries mm-hmm. out. But they always bought their
well,
groceries
okay,
here.
Okay, this was about the same time period.
And they bought their ice.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, out there, they even had a system of flags so that if you worked for a certain fish house, you flew a certain flag. That way the grocery boat could identify you, you know, by that. And they would come up to them and offload the shrimp and unload the groceries and fuel and ice and everything else.
Well, you know, in those early days, the ice was made. They had ice houses here,
mm-hmm.
and it was made in blocks. And they put that ice on the, and I guess they chopped it up themselves to put on the catch. But I don't think he'd have that kind of arrangement.
Did he ever,
is the first I'm hearing of that.
Did he ever have a flag?
He did have a flag. Maybe my brother made the flag. But I have a flag. It's a green flag.
No, that was done
years later.
Yeah, that has no bearing.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
The reason we asked, they're really hard to find.
Is that why you lit up?
Well, I'm thinking, we've never seen one.
You mean where they marked who they were fishing for?
Yes.
Right.
Now, you see, this is the first I've heard, but as far as I know, they got their groceries before they left here.
Okay, yeah.
And they got their ice.
Mm-hmm. Before they left.
And then, like I said, years ago, we had a couple of ice houses in Patterson. They buy the block ice. I can remember the big old tongs they had to pick that ice up with.
Were those types of fishermen that you just mentioned boat owners they owned their own boat?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's probably the difference because my dad owned all of the boats.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the shipping aspect of it? Making the contacts with the restaurants, and I'm sure you must have had regular customers that they serviced over and over again, regular routes, I'm sure, when they sent the fish out. They didn't just go out there hoping to sell it. Can you explain a little bit
about
how
that
worked?
Well, in the early days, I don't know. But later on, he had a broker in, I think it was Washington, D.C. I forget the man's name. Do you remember, Daddy?
No.
He doesn't remember. And he would send the shrimp to him, and he would
Okay, so it was just strictly a case of getting it to his warehouse, and he would distribute them.
Well, yeah. A broker would tell him where to...
I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We would call that person a consultant.
Or an agent.
Now, Joseph, you worked on the boats?
Yes, worked on the Menhaden boats.
On the
right.
Menhaden.
Yes.
If I use the term Florida, is that a boat name you recognize?
No.
Okay. That's all right. I'll explain later.
Okay.
But when did your dad first become involved in the Menhaden? I mean, he was well established, obviously, as a shrimp industry.
Yeah, they came to him. George Wallace came to him. George Wallace was from North Carolina. They came to him. Now, I don't know if that was in the 55, 54. I don't remember when he started in the Menhaden.
Was there any Menhaden fishing going on before these contacts? I mean, in this area? So.
They were doing it in North Carolina and right. Virginia.
Right, but I meant strictly in the Patterson, Morgan City area.
Not that I know of. Mm-hmm. And they, he accumulated a fleet of, through the years, of Menhaden boats that were built at the Patterson shipyard, which he owned and unfortunately gave half to someone.
So if I say Zapata Haney, Zapata Haney's boats were probably owned by your father.
No.
Maybe not all of them. No.
Zapata was a different operation.
But I know that you were producing boats. So if I say Zapata Haney, was Zapata Haney buying boats from the Patterson shipyard? No.
Different, okay. Different operation entirely.
All right.
I think
he fed our boats unloaded at Louisiana Menhaden and Cameron.
All right.
And Empire Menhaden.
All right.
And Empire Louisiana.
Okay.
That was the, my father owned a share in those factories, but the boats that he owned, that's where they unloaded, the Menhaden.
Now they operated out of Morgan City as a home base, or out of Cameron?
One set out of Cameron.
Just like I said.
Out of Empire.
During the season.
Right, well, I know they deposited their catch there. I just didn't know if they were
based there.
That's
where they stayed during the Menhaden season. At the end of the season, all the boats that my father owned came back to Patterson.
For repair
and
upkeep.
Right.
Yearly maintenance.
Now, one of the things we've learned is that the captains of these boats, some of them would live in the Carolinas or Virginia. Mm-hmm. And they would come to Louisiana and work the Louisiana season, then go back to Virginia and work the Virginia season. So they were almost 6 months, 6 months. It doesn't work exactly that. Is that correct to your knowledge?
Well, most of those guys did come from those areas as far and work this season. As far as the seasons up there, not quite sure on that. Maybe there was some overlap, but I'm not sure if it was actually a six-month.
Okay.
Well, the season here went from April, I think it was the third week of April, or the second week of April, to the end of October. And they extended it a couple of years back till November. After that, that's the off-season, then the boats would come here
now
for repair.
Most of the crews, were they coming from the Virginia and the Carolinas
too? At first, the captains.
Well, I knew the captains were, but we're talking about the crew members below that rank.
I'm sure they brought like their pilot and their engineer with them, but the other labor that got into the same boats were probably people from the areas.
Okay.
Is there another name for the same boats? I've heard the word Doric or something
that. The only thing we refer to them was purse boats.
Purse boats.
Yeah, because they purse seine is the net type. Mm-hmm.
And how big would the seine have been?
Somewhere 1,200 feet in that range, I think.
What the seine? Pogie nets, Daddy, how big were they?
That's about a quarter of a mile.
Yeah, about 1,200 feet.
Wow.
And why they call it, the purse seine is actually flotation on top of the net, and as they circled the fish, there was a line running through a set of rings at the bottom of the net, and it closed it up at the bottom like a person made a purse.
Mm-hmm.
And then you retrieved your net and then actually pumped them on board the fish, or in the old days, scooped it with a big bucket-type device.
Was it a bucket type? I've never quite understood. Was it a bucket type device that was done by hand, or like a mechanical arm picking up?
It was basically a concrete bucket that they would use in construction as a crane would pick it up and set it and dump it in the bottom.
Okay.
It's very similar to that from my knowledge and pictures and things, not actually seeing that type. You know, as we came along with technology, they began to use a pump, a centrifugal type pump,
that the, it would just suck the fish right out of the net.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But basically hanging off of rope and tackle, go in, I guess sit it down in there or some type, how they would scoop it, and right. then pick it up and bring it up over the hold and then and dump the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Now the fishing grounds, did that change over time? Or were they fishing basically the same general areas or from the start till later?
The way they found fish changed, of course, because they started using spotter planes.
Right.
And they would, wouldn't they throw some...
yeah, they used to...
Big
years,
firecrackers down there? Cherry bombs?
Cherry bomb type firecrackers to, you know, stimulate just to see if there was any activity in the area. They kind of had an inclination. You can see there's different... things you can see fish up on top of the water with what they call a rip, or you can see some color, and you know, these guys from the East Coast with years and years of experience can actually, and it's one thing that amazed me is they could look at the water and I could see water and they could see fish.
Well, the fish kind of stirred the water up.
Yeah, had that. They kind of did a little mud in the mud. You'll see that periodically, but and that was the advantage of spotter planes. They could see them real well in schools.
Well, for a 7-month season, essentially, 8-month if you go to November, your equipment had to be in pretty good running order. Because, you know.
Well, they had mechanics at these factories. If the boats had problems, they work all night to get them out the next morning.
And these were all diesel powered?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
How large was a crew on a typical boat?
In the old days, I'm not quite sure, and I think it was a little more extensive. I may be wrong, but when I was on the boat, early 80s, late 70s, in that time frame, there was about 17, if I remember. Sounds like a good number, 15, 17.
You had to have quite a few to get into that first boat and spread mm-hmm. that net and everything.
How long did they chant and did they chant and pull the net?
That was in the old days when everything was by hand.
Uh huh.
And you know, those guys just to keep in rhythm and together and pulling, they had all these different chants. And
do you remember any of them?
No,
that was before.
What's that?
The chants.
Oh no. I don't remember. I have a tape of Menhaden fishing, and I haven't looked at it in years, so I don't know if they're chanting on that or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we're trying to get a better understanding is that you mentioned there was a facility at Cameron, facility at Venice. Well, people had to live there. So did they, and again, in the early years, did they live on a camp boat? Did they build some sort of temporary quarters? Did they live on the boats? Because when you start taking the number of boats involved, and if you multiply it times 20, and you got 30 boats, you got 600 people, that's not an insignificant number of people perhaps working in the early 1950s.
Yeah, but it's comparable to the workforce at, you know, at a sugar mill at the, you know, the early 20th century. And I'm just kind of curious, too, to see how they accommodated the workers, because the mills, the sugar mills, had to do the same thing.
Well, a lot of them lived on the boats, and then you had some captains that lived right there, and they got off the boat, but the crew, I think most of them stayed on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a galley to feed them and food to feed them, you know, groceries are bought every day or whatever, and...
You know, back in the old days, prior to refrigeration of fish, these vessels would go out basically on one day, leave before daylight, come back after sunset, offload.
Offload at night.
So those guys would typically, you know, they'd stay on the boat, mm-hmm. especially if the guys were from the East Coast or, you know, those guys that come down. In the later days with refrigeration, you know, and you had so-so days and you had great days, but you were able to anchor out, stay, you know, refrigeration run to keep the fish in good, you know, keep them cold and where they wouldn't rot and those kind of things. So, you know, everybody stayed on the boat. But most of the guys did stay. If they lived local, you got in, got offloaded, most of the time they could go home.
Yeah, because I know in Cameron, there was actually what looked to me like a dormitory facilities. Now, this is not a big dormitory, but it was clear this is a place almost like a motel room, mm-hmm. with a little air conditioning unit. So that's why I asked the question. Logic tells you they slept on the boats. But as you got more sophisticated, mm-hmm. we're just curious if perhaps on the land-based side, they built small dormitories or someplace, even a trailer. Someplace you could go, be air conditioned, stretch your legs, that kind of thing. And there's nothing in the literature that tells us if that was done at all. And so
now, I know they had my dad had a house for the net men, because he had net men at both factories.
Hmm.
To repair the nets, if they needed to be repaired, hmm. they worked all night. Now, as far as the crew and all that, I'm really not sure about that. Did they stay on the boats, Dad?
Yeah.
He said they stayed on the boats.
And if there's some type of dormitory facility that was very isolated, or either something that's come about in the last 20 years or so.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, your family interest in shrimping predates the family interest in menhaden.
Yes.
So you could almost divide this by World War II. Prior to World War II, and perhaps a little bit after, we were in the shrimp business. After World War II, we were in the menhaden business. That doesn't mean you couldn't have been still shrimping. I don't want to imply that it wasn't there. But it was clear that if you look at this in a straight line, we come from St. Augustine to Louisiana as shrimpers. We go offshore and begin to take advantage of the jumbo shrimp. And then at World War II, we see a transition from roughly up to 1954, somewhere near. Then we got into the menhaden business. The menhaden business right now would be not quite 55 years old. And then you had almost 50 years before then. So your family has 100 years, pretty much, involved in the fisheries. So I think what we're also interested in that pre-World War II shrimping, because the jumbo shrimp put Morgan City on the map. That single fisheries allowed Morgan City to claim shrimp capital of the world, along with Biloxi and along with others.
Right.
But so if you could give us some insights, and even though you may not have lived it, you may have heard the stories. We'd like to hear a little bit about that fishery as well, because certainly the mechanization was not nearly as well developed until the post-World War II.
I do remember my dad talking on the phone all the time, and at one point the shrimp were measured in barrels. Boat came home in with so many barrels. And then toward the end of that, they had another standard, which was boxes, and that was a smaller standard. Mm-hmm. Boxes of shrimp. So
he started here in 1938.
Was your family involved at all with the canneries, the shrimp canneries, before refrigeration?
No.
Okay.
No.
Now, when you talk about boxes, are we talking about a wooden box or something made of paper?
I don't know. I think it was had to have been some kind of standard of measure.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know what that was, just the terminology.
Well, Don, the reason Don's asking that is because of the proximity of Patterson to the William Cyprus operation, which made boxes, Cyprus boxes, for all sorts of industries.
And oh, I see.
I don't think it was that. I don't know how they came to call it boxes.
He's going to go.
My husband, he don't want to get involved, but he knows a lot.
Well, and again, if it was Cyprus boxes, that is a tie between
one industry to the other.
Exactly. It's just like over here, there's Mill Road.
The mill was right back
there. There you go.
But the Cyprus industry had faded and then the new industry was the shrimp industry, mm-hmm. because they didn't plant trees that they, after they cut them down, to have more in the future.
Sure.
So we're talking 1938, and that would have been towards the end of the great Cypress logging industries.
Oh, yeah. Which basically dies around World War II. So. Mm-hmm.
But you can see, we're trying to, you live in Patterson, you live in Patterson and Morgan City. Both of you have this tremendous interest in Cypress logging. You also have the interest in fisheries. Early fishing vessels were made of wood. So the question we ask, well, were they made of cypress?
Mm-hmm.
Were there shipwrights locally? And with Portuguese influence, remember the Portuguese have an enormous history of fisheries. Well, all of this could tie together, and that's what Carl and I are trying to work out in our own minds, if one industry depended on the other industry simply because of proximity.
Right.
I can't see it.
Okay.
One thing I forgot to tell you, when my daddy's father died when he was 9 years old, so he went to work in the sardine business over there. Whether it was a factory, and then as he got a little older, he got on the boats, and then he saved his money, and that's how he got to to the States. Did he tell you any?
Well, getting to the box standard and whatnot, how it became that, if it was the size of a box, you know, whatever dimensions that they had, but in terms of that weight class is 100 pounds, 100 pounds of shrimp.
A box was 100 pounds of shrimp.
Right. I had to go clarify that.
Okay.
I kind of thought that.
Well, so well, what was a barrel?
What was a barrel?
Well, I suspect it's a container easy to transport in trucks if you're,
right,
you know, so you're switching, because that's the period when the shippers of various commodities began to move from trains to trucks. And
who was, did your father have his own trucks? Or were they, was it
my
like?
Dad had his own trucks when they, I can show you a picture with us and it shows the truck.
Mm-hmm.
So
these were about one ton size trucks.
We had some good photographs.
Yeah, because if you think of the period, the roads were not. Now, after World War II, we start getting better, but prior to World War II, the roads were pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a family member making record trips to.
But see, here's the truck, but you can't see all of it. Yeah, this is all of us standing. Now, that's in front of the.
Oh, yes.
His first shrimp company.
Yes, yes. And it says J-O-H. That would be for John, Joseph.
See, what on there?
See, on the side, on the door, do you read where it says J-O-H?
J-O-H, yeah.
Would it be John, Joseph?
Would that be?
It's John Santos Carinas.
All right.
That's what he's putting on there. So you see him part of John.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
And this is a... This is the four oldest ones. She came later. But anyway, that's what you're seeing is
all right.
Part of John.
That was probably, how old were you? What you think that was probably 1940, 41, 42 maybe?
I was born in 35. We came here in 38. So I must have been about.
You want to see your mom?
6 or 7 years old, something like that.
early 40s during World War II.
Okay, well, while we're on the subject of World War II, how did the war affect your dad's operation? I mean, was he able to get gas? I know gas was rationed.
Now, that I don't know. I know one man here that had a fleet of boats. He was an Italian, and he had boats named like Mussolini, and the government came and made him change the names on them. But as far as how the war affected, it looked like they kept on fishing. I don't know.
They took some of your daddy's boats and made fire boats out of
pump pumps. Were they shrimp boats?
Yeah.
He took some of, you heard him?
No, I didn't.
He took some of the boats and made fire boats out of them.
Really?
Okay. Some of the shrimp boats.
Sure. Well, how big of a shrimp fleet did he own?
Well, in those days, I don't know. We had lots of boats. We have pictures of the earlier boats, or we had them.
We got them somewhere.
Huh?
There's one right there.
Did you get the other ones back?
Well, he's got them.
Ginger, what boat is that?
I don't know, but it's an old
boat. That's a social. That was one, his first shrimp boat.
His first shrimp boat.
And it was run with kerosene.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how he got the name Kerosene Joe. Mm-hmm.
About when did they make the switch over to gas-driven engines? Do you have any idea?
Did they go to gas or diesel?
When they came here, they were using, I'm sure, diesel, I guess, mm-hmm. on Daddy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then your dad sent my father to school, diesel school, in Philadelphia, so that he could repair boats.
Mm-hmm. Well,
just a minute. Now, the social, that was your dad's first boat?
To my knowledge, some of these articles, they're not saying that, but
okay.
That's what we always heard, that was his first boat.
Now, that boat came from Florida here?
No, I don't think. I think he did that, fished that one in Florida.
Was it built in Florida?
Huh?
Was the social built in Florida?
He bought it from someone, I believe.
The reason I ask, Joseph, getting back to a Florida or a Biloxi, in the shrimp business of Biloxi from Biloxi, the wheelhouse is in front.
Oh, it's top of the
right. A Florida, the wheelhouse is in the back. The social, the wheelhouse is in the middle. I've never seen it.
In this one here?
Yeah, I've never seen it. So what you have is maybe one of a very few number of boats with a design that I've never seen. Because we always talk about a Biloxi. That's why I ask about a Florida.
Right.
Clearly that tells you where they're from. This one
is in the middle.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go look at some books I have at the house to try to figure it out. So what you have is one of the most unique boat types. Carl has a colleague at ULL that knows, I mean, he's really highly skilled in boats. And we'd like to, not today, but sometime come and scan that so we can show it to some of our colleagues. It's good. I'm sorry, I get a little excited.
That's good.
We had a great big one in the office, but I don't know who got that when we, took stuff out before we sold the building.
But do you still have a large
and
collection of pictures?
That boat is on that copy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you see you have a schooner here.
That's not the social.
No. And schooners were very important in Louisiana early on.
Yeah, because they could navigate in shallow water. Yeah.
They were also good in rum running.
Speaking of which, have you heard any stories about the fishing industry here and its involvement in all of that during Prohibition?
And all the what? I don't quite understand.
Well, with the
running booze. Running liquor.
Oh, no. I never heard of it.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Oh, no. We know it happened.
Well,
this is South Louisiana, after all. We know it happened. And we know, I can show you people that were involved. Yeah. What is this article from?
That was out of the National Fishery Magazine,
Southern
1955, yeah. December of 55. And I guess the reason I didn't get one, that's the year, a month I was married, and I guess I wasn't around when he was giving them out.
Have it. Carla, see the boat?
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like it was rigged for sale, so it was kerosene-powered
or diesel-powered. Yeah.
That boat didn't come down here.
The social.
Yeah.
No, it was built here.
No.
No?
That boat was in Florida.
After,
He had another boat that he built and called it the Social.
Okay. Well, at the time this was published, it was still operating out of Brunswick, Georgia, the Social. So apparently it changed hands.
Brunswick.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you see, after he sold it, it's still
in operation.
That was according to this date. Mm-hmm. But he bought this boat with several people, and then he eventually bought them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says here he had a schooner that had been motorized, but it's a lovely little schooner. And you see where the wheelhouse is
mm-hmm.
compared to the.
Now that's so called a what when it's in the front?
That's a biloxi.
A biloxi. Mm-hmm. And
in the back it's a Florida.
Florida. And in the middle you don't know.
Never seen one before.
That's amazing.
I've never seen one in South Louisiana before. Mm-hmm. And the reason we ask those questions is that it's like learning to build anything. You build it based on a tradition that your daddy taught you and your daddy's daddy, and so you carry that tradition. So when we see a boat type, it tells us a great deal about the families who made it, and perhaps where they learned their skills, and that skill I've not seen. I've not seen one with the right in the middle.
Well, you see, this boat was on the East Coast,
right.
Never came here. I mean, it was obsolete by the time he came.
But you see, what was happening here wasn't happening in a vacuum. It's what Don is trying to say, that there are connections with other ports and areas along the Gulf that strongly influence what's going on here. And it's a two-way street. This area is influencing other areas too. But that's something people don't generally look at.
That's my Uncle Jack Gomez Carinas. Mm-hmm. And when the boys came over from Portugal, the four brothers, and Anne said that two came before, I didn't know that. They all took their middle names because the United States was only accepting one person from each family at that time.
Huh.
So my daddy was John Santos, Jack Gomez, Manuel Jesus, and Tony Lopez.
Well, the Portuguese spelling has no Z's. Mm. What happened was, see, that's Jack Gomes.
Gomes.
And Anthony Lopes. What happened after they came down here, somebody got, you know, a lot of names around here.
The French had to get that other syllable in.
Sure. Oh, sure. No. And that's been going on for centuries.
Yes.
Well, you see,
our language changes.
All my school records here is under Santos. I didn't know my name was Carinas until I went off to school. My last name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when your father recruited the Portuguese through an attorney in, I assume, Lisbon, we'll say.
Yeah, it was Lisbon.
And then they came here, did they come for a long period of time or just for a short period of time?
Well, they came. Some of them came and stayed, and some worked the season and went back.
Now, are any of those families still here?
Oh, they didn't really bring their families. Just the men came, and they...
It was on a work visa, I suppose.
They still have some that are in at the Menhaden and Company and Empire. The one in Louisiana Cameron doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The lease came due, and the people that owned the land wanted too much money, so they... tore it down and said bye-bye. And the one in Empire, I think they still have some of these Portuguese net men. Now, as far as how many, I don't know.
How long were the boats? Joseph.
Daddy, how long were the boats, do you know?
Jody doesn't know. I don't.
Jody, how long were the boats?
Like the bogey boats?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were
about 165.
165 feet was the biggest ones that we constructed.
And how much would they hold?
We calculated what we called about 1,000 when they dump a load of, you know, each dump at the factory was 1,000 fish, and most of those would hold about 1.1 million fish, as we called it. I remember it's about 70 tons of fish.
Something. 70 tons.
I think it's something in that.
Because I've read 600 and I'm thinking, that's a lot of weight. But a zero would be easily to misplace. Uh-huh. You know, it's typing, adding a zero.
I was really trying to think of my calculation. From what I understand, one dump at the factory, they called it, classified as 1,000 fish, and it was 600 pounds.
All right. And were the I've also been told the captains were paid by the fish?
Yes, the captains and the entire crew were paid. Everybody. By the catch.
All right.
Percentage of the catch.
Okay. All right.
And they got the fish for the oil and the meal. And it fell under the soybean market, and don't ask me why, the prices of the oil. It fell under the soybean market.
And most of it must have been, or a majority of it must have been, processed into chicken feed.
Okay.
Because Dad watched chicken market, poultry market, all the time.
Now, when your family decided to go into the Menhaden side, did you give up the shrimp side?
No.
So it was going on.
No, I kept that going too.
So was your father, we'll call him the CEO, of both sides, or was there another family member running?
Oh no, what with the Menhaden?
When Menhaden and the shrimp fishery.
Well, he was on top of his own business, but he had people under him that were capable of doing things.
I think what he's asking is
he's asking something different.
Is the shrimp side of things was his own.
Yes.
Okay.
He did that home.
And yeah, he didn't
side,
have any partners in that.
Partnered with Mr. Wallace and some others.
All right.
Depending on the amount of shares he owned in each of the factories.
Because it would be a large undertaking to manage both sides simultaneously.
Oh, no. He didn't manage the plants. He made sure he watched his boats and what they brought in and everything to the factories.
And he knew the captains, and he supplied the captains to the boats.
All right.
Now, we're talking about the factories. About how many employees were there on the two different sides? Do you have any idea?
On the factories?
Right. That's in the shrimp processing area.
Yeah, the shrimp processing wasn't a lot. I mean, it was pretty simple. It was maybe 5 or 6 guys.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a youngster, we would go in.
Well, they had to unload them on a conveyor belt, and then they had to weigh them. And box them. They used to put them in 5-pound cartons.
And in the heyday, they would have headers.
Mm-hmm.
When
mm-hmm.
the people couldn't, they couldn't head the shrimp, mm-hmm. all of the shrimp on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, there are two seasons in Louisiana. There's a May season and an August season. May season, brown shrimp, August, white shrimp. Did he fish both?
With the Gulf, did they have that? I don't know.
No.
Everything that he did was offshore fishing.
So he was deep water,
he was
nothing near
nothing,
shore.
Right. He didn't have
nothing
any.
It was white shrimp.
All right.
Except maybe in early.
Well, they brought in some brown, but all of his boats went out all to the Gulf. They didn't.
So they were all steel
inland.
Hulls?
Yes.
All steel hulls?
Yes.
Okay.
Later?
Yes, yes.
At first they weren't.
They were wood hulls. All right.
Wood hulls, steel hulls, then fiberglass.
And then you brought the shrimp to Patterson or Morgan City?
Patterson.
We didn't have nothing to do with Morgan City. I don't know how Morgan City got that title anyhow.
I just asked the question.
No, my father had nothing to do with Morgan City.
At one point, he built an ice house. And the boats from Morgan City would come down the Atchafalaya to purchase ice, then go out and fish it. But, you know, we did it mainly for ourselves, but it became lucrative.
That was much later when there wasn't.
It was later.
They didn't have many boats then, and mostly most of them were independently owned.
Yes.
I think at one time in the early days, Annie could probably tell us this, how many of those plants there was. Grandpa, Versaggi.
Oh, the shrimp plants?
Here in
well, Patterson. Felice Galena was first, then my daddy. Then you had Joe Ramos. You had the Versaggis. I think that's it here.
And the Hardys came along later.
Yeah, but the Hardys were in, they came here later, but they fished out of, I think, Morgan City for a while, and then they came here.
What about Uncle Jack?
Oh, yeah, he was here, but he moved on to Brownsville. When Brownsville started, they started catching more shrimp there. He moved on to Brownsville.
That was in the 40s.
Okay.
So at one time, would you think in, say,
well, my
40,
daddy,
I mean,
another
operations?
Thing, my daddy opened a fish house in Brownsville. And some of his boats were fishing out of there.
And our brother ran that, mm-hmm. the day-to-day.
And they ship shrimp from there in trucks also.
Hmm.
But by that time, they must have been refrigerated trucks.
Yeah, they were.
You see, in the early days, they weren't.
Well, it's the early days we think is important also, because there's a certain amount of ingenuity in moving a product that's highly perishable to a market.
To market, especially given the road conditions of the time. No, so I can well understand your
how they got there in good condition, I don't know, but he made a fortune.
Well, it's important. I mean, you work hard. You
well,
do,
like I said, they put them in boxes and iced it down.
That's his
name. They might have poured some rock salt on top of them to keep the ice from melting.
Right.
For
yes.
all I know.
Yes.
His name was Alfred Convenuto, and I could not think of it. But they named him Smoky Pete because he could
move quick through the move product.
I believe I can remember that.
Now, how long was your family in the business?
Too long.
He came here in 38. I think we sold in the 90s.
In the 90s. Close enough. 60 years. Let's just say, round it off, 60 years.
It's an impressive
run. Didn't I put a picture up here we sold it?
I saw it. It's in one of these, yes, and it's 97, I think.
Was it 97?
Yeah. Well, that's an impressive.
Well, it had
history.
Already closed. We closed it in 90.
Okay.
One of the big changes that occurred in the Gulf over the course of this period is the emergence of offshore oil drilling, and you know, with the emergence of all of these offshore platforms and drilling rigs. Did that affect the shrimping industry, the Menhaden fishery out there at all?
I don't think it did.
Not at all.
No, I'm just curious.
It actually took some of the shrimping guys in the industry who became supply vessels for the oil industry as they began. Several guys here that actually, you know, in the oil industry became work boat owners.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they'd gotten away from the shrimp and then went strictly working for the oil field. Yeah.
Now, what about the dead zone?
What you looking
Has
for?
It affected?
I was just looking for that 97 day.
Oh,
the Menhaden business.
I must have brought that back in here.
You know, not being around it for the last 20 years.
Okay.
You know, it's really hard to say.
What is the dead zone?
Excuse me. Lack of oxygen. High nitrogen load comes down to Mississippi, and the offshore current pushes it towards Texas, so you get this long, elongated plume in which the fish are just, there's no oxygen.
So they can't survive. Nothing that breathes oxygen can survive in it.
And it changes in size, but it's in the area that, it's not the prime zone. The prime zone tends to be towards the delta. But it's nevertheless an area that could be impacted.
The shrimping side, I'm not sure because of, you know, the dead zone. You know, do they classify that as from surface to seafloor?
Yeah.
You know, and then you got some things. As far as the Menhaden, you know, that fish is typically, you're fishing maximum 2-3 miles offshore. Everything mm-hmm. is pretty much close to the beach. So that I think the dead zone typically stays further offshore.
Okay, so, that makes sense. Sure.
So you got a lot of...
they used to fish a lot in Britain Sound off of Empire.
For menhaden or for shrimp?
Menhaden.
All right.
But they still go out, they would go out too.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they were, all right, when the offshore oil industry started, Mobil Oil had a camp in Morgan City that allowed people to get to ship shoal. So we suddenly see that there's another new industry added to the mix. Your father never got involved in any way in the offshore oil and gas business?
He had some, the Black Duck and all. What did they do, Daddy?
They worked for the oil industry.
He had a few of them.
Okay.
One or two boats that worked for a while. Mm-hmm. But he didn't stay in it.
Well, was it the Diamond Jim and oil survey boat? Wasn't it built as a survey boat?
No, the Diamond Jim was built as a yacht, a pleasure boat. And he had another one called the Bucare. Do you remember the Bucare?
Yes, yes.
Those were yachts he built for just to go out and have a good time. But he had one, the Black Duck, and I don't know which was sure. a shrimp boat. I don't know. I don't remember it.
Yeah, that may have been what I refer to as some of the other shrimping.
I can't just, believe that Daddy would build anything.
We need
just
a boat.
Pleasure.
Can you come bring some glass bars or something? Sure. Yeah, they do that and going by the very way.
Not that he did.
That's why I brought it up, because right. you had a long history by then. In 1947, come in the 30s, you had at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the oil industry was looking for anybody that could teach them how to get to where they had to go.
Right, exactly.
Right. And that's now along the LaForge area, that's exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
I'm going to find out about the Diamond Jim, and I don't know about the Vucare, but I believe that that was an oil survey boat.
Well, it might very well have been.
And
it,
he did outfit it for himself and for us. But it was too much of a workboat. It wasn't like any yacht that you would think
well,
of.
You might be right, because I'll tell you why. My neighbor and another man rode out. Was it on the Diamond Jim, Daddy?
Yeah.
On the Diamond Jim, they rode out Hurricane Audra in Cameron on that boat. Ooh. You're right.
That's...
Now, when Audrey hit Cameron, it just about ruined my dad as far as the menhaden business. The season had, that happened in June, June 20-something. The season started in April. It was just getting started good when it hit. Well, it, of course, messed up the plant. Not only... And all the people that died, do you all remember anything about Audrey?
Oh, yes. Oh, I lived through it.
Well, you were there?
No, I wasn't in Cameron, but I was about 60 miles inland, and that was bad enough.
Oh, really? Well, anyway, they used those menhaden boats to carry bodies to Lake Charles. But
what was the date of that?
That was
1957.
So I was 10.
My son was 50. Was 6 weeks old when that hit. My oldest boy. So
and
it was. I think it was 20 something.
I think you're right. No.
And I remember riding with Dad. Mama was there too, I believe. To Cameron, and the picture that I remember. It's nothing to do with the fishing industry. It was a cow. One half the cow was on this side of the barbed wire, and the other half was on that side.
Well, they had a tidal wave there.
Just hanging there. I mean, it wasn't alive, of course. But I just... It was just
But anyway,
major.
He was able to come back with the aid of some friends as far as like giving him credit for the fuel until he, you know, and then, of course, they had to get the plant back, and the operation and the season was just ruined that year.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did your mother interact in all of this?
When they lived in Florida, and she worked with him when they unloaded boats. He might have had a place there. I don't remember, but I do know that she worked there with him in the business. But over here, no. She was strictly a housewife and mother.
And a good one.
Excellent. Excellent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was of that generation that was extremely subservient.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to her credit that she had a circle of friends, Italian friends, who were in the same boat, so to speak, and they sort of supported each other through the man things, so to speak. And
man, you don't have to get into all that.
Well, I think it's important. These women were way stronger than we are. You know what we do? We just say, go. But they stuck it out.
They were raised during the Depression.
And that's to their credit. They were
raised during the Depression, and they didn't throw their money away, even though they had it. And very frugal. Very strong people.
Well, Carl's parents and my parents both went through the Depression. So we're not young whippersnappers. We fully understand precisely what you're saying.
I heard stories where they went from Florida to Texas City looking, they passed through here looking for fishing grounds, and they slept on the box springs. Now, I'm not talking about on the springs, not box springs. And then they came, and then they finally ended up here. But all that was during Depression, or maybe right after.
Was there a fall off, a tremendous fall off in the amount of shrimp that they could ship out? I mean, obviously, it's a luxury item, the shrimp is, and during the Great Depression, they must have taken a tremendous hit, you know, in their ability to, or is it a case of the people who can afford it are going to buy it regardless of what the economic circumstances are like?
Well, I don't know. He was still in Florida and all during the Depression, and they survived it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether there was a market for the shrimp and all that, I can't tell you that.
Okay.
What date were you born?
I was born in 1935.
And Joyce? 34?
Joyce was 32. And
Johnny?
Johnny was 31, I believe, okay. Or 30. He and Joyce were a year and a half apart.
Okay.
And Joe was born in 36.
Okay.
So you were about 2 when you came to Louisiana?
I was 3 years old.
Okay.
Came here in 38.
All right. So it'd been right after the Depression. Close enough.
Well, as it's winding down,
yeah,
it doesn't really end until World War II.
Well, the Depression lasts for several years.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was born during the Depression, 32. So Mom and Daddy had 2 children during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was coming to an end when I came along in 35.
Right, it's winding down. We were on the subject just now of hurricanes, and we just want to get some of your observations about how the storms of the last 10 years or so, or since Andrew, I guess, have changed the Patterson area.
I can't see where it has, I think.
No. I don't think it's really changed as you see, mm-hmm, you know, driving or whatever. The big change is through, of course, the marshland. I fish quite a bit down the Atchafalaya. I'm a saltwater fisherman, and it's been a tremendous change.
Well, can you talk a little bit about that? What kind of changes have you seen?
just the disappearance of land. I mean, we're very fortunate here with the Chaffalo River system to actually gain land. You've mm-hmm. seen some gains in a lot of places, mainly on the channel in that. But in other areas away from that, you see the disappearance of land. Oh, I think that really...
Patterson is above sea level, seven miles or seven feet above sea level. We rode out Andrew here. Mm-hmm. I was at my mother's, and my husband and his niece was here. That was a wicked storm. And that thing never had an eye. I mean, it blew for over 12 hours. Mm. I don't stay anymore. We go.
Where do you go?
Well, a lot of times we just took off and were fortunate enough. We always go west and north. And fortunate enough to find a motel without reservations. Now I have a son that lives in Monroe, so that's where we head.
That's okay. That's okay.
That's good.
That's good. Just leave early.
We did. Before this last one hit, which one was the last one?
Gustav.
I was drinking coffee in the bed. My husband came in there and said, we better go. Instead of telling me that the night before. But anyway, we got out of here by 9:30. No traffic at all. We were in Monroe by, 1:30. But when they give that evacuation order, that's when you run into the troubles. You just soon stay put, because you don't make any time on the road.
Now, when you're fishing the salt, where do you fish?
Typically, Point of Fair Island, which is the east side of the river.
Which side?
The east side of the Chaffalo.
Right.
That area, Four League Bay, over into Lost Lake, down to Oyster Bayou, and that area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after Gustav, a prominent fishing inlet that we go into to access Point of Fair Island, is a place called Pellerman's Cut. And they, probably about 10, 12 years old, 12 years ago, they installed a weir there to keep, you know, the running and the erosion out of that pass. But after Gustav passed, the rock area and the weir that you could cross, it was about 4 feet under average turn, you just slow down and cross over. But after Gustav, it left a 50-foot gap, approximately 50, 60-foot gap to the north of that small inlet right there. And so that's just one indication of actually in the marsh area and the small lakes and everything, it changes the depth, and it's just basically, in my opinion, it's just taking the marsh and the meat of the marsh and it's just laying it out and leveling it out in the northern border.
How long have you been fishing Oyster Bayou?
Probably about 20, 25 years.
All right. On the east, no, the west side, do you remember the shrimp drying platform that
yes.
was there? What's left of it?
It's been maybe a few pilots.
That's it.
Maybe a few pilots sticking up. But
was there enough there to tell you about how big it was, the approximate size?
Yeah, a few years back you could actually see the tops, and I would say probably what I can recall, maybe I would say 100 feet by 30, 40 feet.
Okay.
Yeah, from what was
that left. Was probably the westernmost platform ever built in the state.
Really?
Yeah, and we've been told that many of them were about a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And so your approximations is a little smaller.
Right.
Now, when you saw the piling, about how far out of the water were they? We're getting some mixed notions on this one.
Well, actually, I think there's still some piling that are sticking up in the marsh, on the land itself.
Mm.
And unless that was part of the shed or some kind of cover like that. But right now, I would say those pilings, maybe 2-3 feet, maybe 4 feet out the water as of now.
Yeah. Yes. No, that's exactly what we were told, somewhere between 4 and 5 feet, so you get air underneath them.
What were these platforms for?
To dry shrimp.
Dry shrimp.
Oh.
For the shrimp, the little packs. Of, most of it shipped to China, but some of it's still marketed here.
You can buy it.
Awesome.
I like it.
Mm. I don't like it, do you?
Not particularly, but I've eaten it in Lent all my life. So.
Well,
you like it?
It was before ice.
I'll be Vernus eats it, but I don't.
And so before ice, you had to have some ways to preserve the product. So you air dried it outside. You boiled it in super saline water. Then you laid it out to air dry. 2 days.
Right.
2.5 days.
And people shuffle their feet over it in the early days to get the shells off.
Okay, awesome.
And it was the company that handled them in Louisiana had an exclusive right to distribute to China. And they were just amazed. Well, we're still trying to figure out the weight. You know, it could easily be 20 or 30, 40 tons that went to China by boat. Because that's the only way you get it. So we're still trying to work that one out. We're not there yet.
But it takes about 8 or 10 pounds of fresh shrimp to make 1 pound of dried shrimp. So.
Wow. Oh, they're not still doing that, are they?
Yes.
I know you can buy it, so they must be doing it somewhere.
In the Houma area.
Houma?
Mm-hmm.
So this would be the brown shrimp?
Well, no, not necessarily.
No.
The small ones.
Yeah.
It's sometimes. It's sometimes called seabob, which is a corruption of the term six barb. And six barb got changed to seabob. They're very small, but
they
didn't throw anything away. They got out there, they dried it. They drive fish, they drive anything. It was all moneymakers. We haven't quite worked out the distribution, but it largely went to Chinatowns. From New Orleans and Houma to San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York.
So back were where, these baby shrimp?
Oh, it's just shrimp that didn't get very big.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Which was
you
not
understand
good.
Why I was...
Which was not good for the shrimpers.
No, but for shrimp drying, it was ideal.
They weren't infant shrimp.
We're still trying to
they
locate
them. They were shrimp that generically did not grow anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. So they weren't...
And they were just packaged in a barrel. I mean, they preserved. In fact, the banana plantations in Middle America, they took a great deal. Because you could take the dried shrimp, put them into rice and a little water, and it'd hydrate back up. And you would get a protein with your starch. And that industry was started by Louisianians as well. So... Trying to work that one out. We're not sure there.
That's a case where there was a connection between these neighboring industries.
Yeah, that you know, that's why the questions are always being asked. You know, where was the connection from where? Mm-hmm. If you had a unique hull design or propeller, did you independently invent it or you learned from somebody else and then you recrafted it a little bit to fit the waters here?
Interesting. My husband worked 20 years for United Fruit Company, so he's familiar with the banana business.
Well, that company was started in Louisiana.
Yeah, because the headquarters were in New Orleans.
New Orleans,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. The Great White Fleet.
Yeah.
So, other questions?
I think that's it. Well, there's one question I'd like to ask. If you do have some of these original pictures, we'd like to be able to come back and scan them. And what we do is just give the family members copies of the files.
Well,
you can take them anywhere and have your prints made.
He has a box of pictures. He couldn't find them.
When they packed away in my hurricane takeaway.
Well,
like most photos you do now, like you say, you learn. You know,
I exactly put all mine in Ziplocs so they don't get wet.
Well, you see, it what we hope to do with this is create a safety net. You know, they're going to be stored away from here, hopefully they'll be there forever. But we can make copies available to family members. You can take them anywhere and have as many prints as you want.
We have several photos and a lot of the grandchildren and all, you know, kind of, when everything kind of dispersed, everybody kind of took what they wanted and what was what they felt good about.
We would be, you know, give us a little time. We'd love to come back. And Carl brought two scanners. I have one. We end up usually with four computers.
Now, when you say scanners. You can scan that picture, do you have to take it out the frame?
No.
Okay. At Marine Ways, where he had the shipyard, right? I know my father, I don't know whether my father also had a shipyard or he worked.
Your dad had a shipyard that was back of Mama's house. And then he sold it to Daddy.
Oh, okay.
Because that was back there.
I didn't know how it came about. I knew my dad had a shipyard, but I didn't
know he had it back
whether
there.
They were one and the same, and apparently they were.
What?
The shipyard. My father had it, and then he sold it to your dad? Or vice versa?
No, no, Ginger. Okay. The shipyard, the Patterson shipyard has always been there.
Yeah.
But there was some land back of Mama's house.
Right.
That your daddy used for a shipyard. He had railway on there. But then Daddy bought that land from him.
Yeah, okay. I didn't know that part.
Hmm. Well, if you have any photos, give us a little time. We're actually one of the large lumber companies is allowing us to go through some of their records.